Football on Off the Ball
with Sky. Don't miss Arsenal versus Everton in the Women's Super League Sunday, live on Sky Sports.
All right, you're welcome along to Thursday's football show. Nathan with you this evening. In a little while, we're going to be talking to Alan Walsh. He is the Director of Operations at Brentford, about everything that goes into his job at the new Premier League High Flyers. That coming up in just a little while. But our focus right now, and of course over the next couple of days, is all about the Republic of Ireland against Azerbaijan. 5 o'clock kickoff in Baku on Saturday evening, with a full coverage throughout Saturday afternoon. All the reaction from Saturday evening and Sunday. Kenny Cunningham is going to be on OTBAM tomorrow morning from 7:30 as well, previewing the game. But we can right now go live to Baku, where Dan McDonnell has been put up in 6-star luxury.
Hey Nathan, how are things? Not quite six star. But I mean, you
the boon is back, Dan. I want to see your expenses that are going into the Indo after this.
Listen, if you've seen some of the absolute dumps I've stayed in over the years, I do not have any dubious reputation in house to, that is going to follow me around. It's like, what was that FBI blazer back in the day who was known as Big Dinners, was his nickname or something like that? Like, I've definitely not gone. I mean, I could run through a selection of absolute dodgy joints I've stayed in over the years, but
is it as good as the place? Was it in Bosnia when Trapattoni was in charge, and that the team were due to stay in a Holiday Inn attached to the stadium? Maybe it was in Slovakia, actually.
Slovakia.
In Zenica or Zelina. Yeah. There's so many of these places, and that the team were meant to stay in a Holiday Inn attached to the stadium. The team were meant to stay in this 5-star luxurious palace about 2 hours outside. And the Trapattoni decided, actually, this is too far away. I'm going to stay in the Holiday Inn right beside the stadium. So they put all the journalists to this luxurious spa resort for 3 days. They were in for a bit of a shock to the system, all the honeymooners.
Oh, I didn't remember that, actually, now to mention it. Yeah, it wasn't a huge amount going on there, to be honest. I mean, it was really for honeymooners, not a place you'd go with around 40 lads, you know. But it was still nice. But listen, Baku is, it's expensive to get here, but very reasonably priced once you do get here. So you can stay in a slightly better class of place than you normally would. That's what I would say.
Are there Irish fans there?
There's nothing dodgy going on here. There is actually, yeah. We're told there's 300 or so Ireland fans travelling. Now, I travelled over yesterday, and I would have spotted some familiar faces, shall we say, and a sprinkling of people on the various flights. Most people would have flown through Istanbul to get here. There might be some other people who've gone through other routes, but that certainly would have been the most popular route. And Ireland fans, some did travel to Portugal last month, but just basically ended up making it as far as Faro. They couldn't go into the stadium. A couple of people got in, as we saw, John Egan's family and a couple of others. But a lot of people watched that game in downtown. But they can get in here. It's like a 70,000 capacity stadium. There's no shortage of Irish tickets available. And quite a few, I think some are arriving tomorrow. So it's not necessarily a case where, you're seeing people wandering around the streets, if you know what I mean. But it is the first normal, I would say, as much as coming, 5,000 kilometres away isn't standard. But it is the first normal away trip, I think, of the Kenny era, in the sense that there's no limitations and restrictions on fans attending. And anyone who wants to be here at great expense, has the facility to be here. So you will see some of the hardcore have made it.
I don't know if Stephen Kenny wanted a sideshow to distract from all the pressure that's on him personally heading into this game, but boy, has he got one. Callum Robinson then woke up yesterday morning and really for the last 24 hours has been the centre of attention around the sporting world. Whatever your views on it, and I think most people would feel he should just go and get the vaccine, he is the poster boy for the unvaccinated professional footballer. You were at the press conference then. Do you think this came as a bit of a shock to Callum Robinson?
Oh, I think it did, yeah. I mean, Callum Robinson does press, as you may have mentioned or maybe mentioned previously on the show, like he does press at every international window pretty much because, as people know, some players don't like doing it. Callum Robinson seems like an easygoing guy, sort of a press officer's dream in the sense that, yeah, I'll do it, no problem. Generally comes in with a smile, deals with it all pretty comfortably. You know, we've spoken to Callum Robinson countless times, and generally they've been decent enough chats. You know, he is sort of a fella that's pretty easy to warm to. But you could see in his face as this went on that maybe he wasn't anticipating that this would go this way. Jason Malumbi last month was faced with the very same question initially and just said, listen, I don't want to go into it, and shut the discussion down. Now, that was also over Zoom, whereas Callum Robinson was in person, and maybe it's easier to shut things down over Zoom than it is in person. Adam Eder would have been asked about it last month. Now, he actually did answer it and said, you know, he had taken the jab, whereas I guess where players who don't answer, people are left to speculate about their own preferences, whereas Callum Robinson decided to go there. But I mean, it struck me, like, I think I saw Miguel Delaney make this point, and it's been made, like, very few players, for all the talk about English football at the moment and the slow take up, Callum Robinson is pretty much the only player that has confirmed he is that he hasn't, unless I'm mistaken. So as a result, a sort of a fairly nondescript or unremarkable in terms of, you know, a news conference in Dublin on a Tuesday ahead of a week where the game is a sort of a bit of a dead rubber. You didn't expect it to maybe have a reach that would take it sort of far and wide. I was sort of watching BBC World earlier and didn't quite reference Callum Robinson, but it seems like a lot of players this week, including the England players, are now facing questions. I think Tammy Abraham said that he has. And as a result, you're seeing players getting these questions. I'm sure they're facing them anyway, but it just seems, because International Week involves travel and you know, crossing borders and meeting up with people, I guess it feels like it's more of a relevant question, whether people like that or not.
Yeah, it does seem to have broken the dam on the question around footballers, because you touch on Tammy Abraham at the England press conference, and Tomori, I think, was asked as well, and the English journalists were frustrated that maybe Harry Kane, the captain, wasn't put out as he normally would be for this press conference, so that he could be asked about his views on it as well, and that every footballer for the coming weeks are going to be asked about their vaccination status. Stephen Kenny's response has been put up alongside Jurgen Klopp's, that, you know, Jurgen Klopp couldn't have come out much stronger, saying that you believe the medics, you believe the science, 99% of the Liverpool squad, compared it to drink driving and the responsibility you have to yourself and to other people. Stephen Kenny wasn't as strong. Would you have expected him to have been stronger, or is it a different position that an international manager is into a club manager?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of both with that. I think he is in a slightly different position. Like, he's not employing these players. I think, you know, you can see, I mean, Stephen Bradley, closer to home, said something. So, I mean, not as strong as Klopp, but said, like, all but one of their players have taken it. I think it's easier for a club, probably, where they have the players 7 days a week, most weeks, to have a discussion or not have a discussion, as it seems to be the case in a number of cases. It's slightly harder for an international manager. Like, I think some people, in fairness, who might have been quite critical of Stephen Kenny generally, would be more so focusing on the association maybe taking the lead than an individual manager.
But what is the lead, Dan? Because I've heard that the association to take a lead. The only lead they could take is insisting that the players are vaccinated, which would be out of kilter with all of Irish employment law. But they may decide, because of even UEFA regulations and close contacts, they want to do this. But the way Stephen Kenny was talking about it, it felt like almost half the squad probably wasn't fully vaccinated.
Yeah, like the figures were vague. It sort of gave you the impression it was like slightly more than single figures. So what's that, 10, 11, 12? I don't think the association can enforce it personally. You know, as much as I'd be, you know, very supportive of the thinking behind that, I just don't think it's realistic for the association to do it. Some may disagree with that. You know, I think for an international manager who's very much under pressure with games to sort of, you know, to save his job, let's be honest, that's what we're going to talk about probably subsequently and over the next couple of days. I mean, if he does have 10 or 11 players in his squad in that boat, is he going to dump them out? I mean, of course he isn't, you know. Now, I think with Stephen Kenny, his answers on the topic, like at times, like maybe his syntax maybe wasn't perfect, in the sense of it gave the impression maybe that he might have been a more ambivalent on the topic, whereas in a way he just sort of kept talking but not beyond his initial comment. And his initial comments were, I trust the experts, I'm vaccinated, you know, I believe the experts. And, you know, he made reference to myths and, you know, stuff that's out there, misinformation, didn't use that specific word, probably alluded to it, and the players are buying into some of that stuff. He just maybe didn't phrase it in the very definitive and strong and authoritative way that Jurgen Klopp did on the same topic. But again, Klopp was coming from the position when he spoke of knowing that his players had already taken the action. Whereas if Klopp was speaking, you know, about a dressing room where half of the players hadn't done it, it might have been harder for him to phrase it so definitively when he had got the buy-in from his group. That hasn't been that buy-in has not been replicated within the Irish setup. So I don't know. I've seen a bit of analysis of Stephen Kenny's words on it. I'm not sure what much more he could have said other than maybe, you know, phrase one or two lines better. But I don't think the sentiment behind of what he was saying was flaky. I was there for the whole thing. I'm not sure if the whole audio or the whole transcript has been put out there of what Stephen Kenny said. I don't think his stance on it was much wrong with what he said. He was left in a slightly difficult position.
And obviously, if any manager has a right to be frustrated around COVID, it's Stephen Kenny with all that has gone on over the past year, particularly around Callum Robinson and the 8 games that Callum Robinson has missed. And looking ahead to the game and possible team selection, Callum Robinson should have been a really important player for Stephen Kenny over the last year, but because of injuries and COVID, hasn't featured as often as he would have liked. Do you see a role for Callum Robinson on Saturday?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I think he probably has to start. I mean, that's the thing. This obviously getting into this broader debate can just expose you to all sorts of views and take you down a sort of a, take you down a road you don't want to go down. And I'm sure you're experiencing and you're seeing a lot of those comments and stuff coming in. The one thing I think you can say with absolute certainty is that, Callum Robinson, and he said it himself, like it's cost him caps. And I think last month in particular, you know, he was not at sharpness to play against Serbia and to play against Azerbaijan when Ireland needed him. And they really did need him. And you saw he came on and was involved in the cross for the goal against Serbia. He was sluggish initially, but made his presence felt against Azerbaijan. And I think at the moment, in terms of the attacking options that Ireland have, he's probably has the he's the most sort of accomplished of the more experienced ones. And as a result, I think he has to start. Yeah.
So Stephen Kenny has by and large gone with the back three. No Dara O'Shea. Are you working off the assumption that Andrew Omobamadele comes in and starts? Matt Doherty's at wing back and the Stevens returns at left wing back. Are there a lot of decisions to be made, do you think, for Stephen Kenny? Or is it aiming towards a team that almost picks itself?
I think a couple of decisions as opposed to a lot. I mean, I do think you will probably stick with that system because to roll back in it now would be slightly strange. The only counterpoint you would say is that, and this is in the no excuses territory for this week, it must be said, they've been in since Monday. You know, they've had five days together, albeit one with travel. You know, so if they wanted to do something different, there's no excuse that they don't have the time to implement something different. But I think if you're looking to build some degree of continuity, which is something that Stephen Kenny is big on generally, I'm not sure if he'd necessarily want to reboot completely. So, yeah, I think your assessment there, what you're talking about, the back three, yeah, I think that's probably correct. Stephen's coming back in, you could debate it, but I think on balance, Stephen's probably would play ahead of James McLean. You kind of wonder, is there a role for McLean further up the pitch? Maybe not in this instance, and maybe he's one who plays against Qatar, but that will be one of the decisions. But I think, yeah, the bigger debates around, there's a couple of them. I think for me, the key ones would be, I think Jeff Hendrick will come in and play with Josh Cullen. I think it's just a matter of whether there's a sort of a front three ahead of them or like a front two and another midfielder. I would have thought he'd like to have Jason Knight involved if he thought he was fully fit, because I think they certainly need a bit of box-to-box energy. And even against Hungary in June, you saw Knight's ability to sort of be versatile, to play on the right of a front three, but a bit narrow if needs be, but he can also operate a bit deeper. And I think he's got to be a real contender to come into the mix.
So if he comes in, are you looking at Robinson and Ida as a front two?
Yeah, I think potentially so, yeah. With the ability to flip that into a 3-4-3 as well, with Knight sort of up on the right as well, you know, with Robinson on the left and Ida through the middle. But, you know, you have a bit of versatility within that. Like they did, I think, 3-4-1-2 and 3-4-3 in the two halves against Hungary. So Knight could also play in the hole as well. Now, the alternative is someone like Jamie McGrath, I think, who is quite a creative player. And if you think Azerbaijan are going to defend deep, you do need people who can pick passes as well, too. And that's potentially the alternative. I would see it as something like Knight versus McGrath, as opposed to, say, I don't see a front three similar to what played in the home game with Connolly, Ida and Parrott, you know, which was very much a front three. It was three players who preferably would play a central striker if they were asked where they would play. I think it might be slightly different this time with Robinson playing, certainly. And I think, yeah, that Knight-McGrath issue is the other one. Yeah, Ogbeni is one as well, who he loves. You know, again, he'd be a right-sided player in a 3-4-3. And he's spoken about not having wingers available, not having that real pace and on the counter that option. But I think Ogbeni is more of one where you would think, hopefully, Ireland are in a strong position in the second half, so Azerbaijan have to come out and play a bit more. That's when Ogbeni is a great option to have off the bench when they're maybe getting a bit tired.
Azerbaijan's home record isn't good. So far in this qualifying campaign, beaten 3-0 last time out against Portugal, and were beaten at home 2-1 by Serbia. I mean, you look back in the Nations League last year, they had scoreless draws with Montenegro, and Cyprus were beaten at home by Luxembourg. Are you of the belief that for Stephen Kenny's future, like, regardless of performance, regardless of long-term planning, any of that, that this is quite simply a must-win?
Yeah, look, it pretty much is. I mean, listen, he's not going to lose his job next week, you know. So, like, he could win, you know, he could win resoundingly in Luxembourg next month, and having drawn this game, and we might have a different discussion then. But it does feel like in the here and now, it is a game that he does need to win. You know, like he will have the window next month to undo it. But you just feel like this is the best chance to win a game of the ones that are remaining. You know, it is the most realistic win that's there. So you sort of have to say, go and seize it now and take the opportunity. And as you say, Azerbaijan, no great shakes, playing in a big 69,000 seater stadium, but like the you know, it won't be full. You know, it's not an intimidating sort of environment. Temperature wise, it's fine. You know, it's not sort of, I was here a couple of years ago in the summer with Dundalk and it was sweltering, and certainly will be a factor. Not the case this time around. So there isn't really excuses, you know, around, say, preparation and tight turnarounds and all of this. So you have to hope that this is a game where the team with better players finds a way to win. And that's what they have to, just to make this a window. Like if Ireland can win this game, it makes it a month where there's a bit of heat taken out of the whole situation, rather than every window becoming a shouting match or a debate or a, you know, pre-match against Qatar on Monday. That's very, you know, where does this all mean? So there comes
a
point where they have.
What is Irish football about, Dan?
Well, that's what we do. But there comes a point where you take some control of the situation. Like, Stephen Kenny's future is still in his own hands, and it's in the hands of his team. I don't think it's predetermined what happens to him. And as a result, there is an opportunity to really take control of the situation by winning a game on Saturday. So it's not game over if he doesn't. But I mean, the best chance of a victory is this one. So take it.
The team and the soundings from the team are like very supportive of Stephen Kenny. It's been quite striking how every player, whether inexperienced or senior, has come out and praised the quality of coaching as much as anything else. They do seem to be rowing in behind Stephen Kenny and the long-term plan that is in place. Is that something that you've noticed a change in even over the last couple of months, how vocal those players have become in support of Kenny?
Look, you know, players that are sent out to be asked about their manager are generally always going to give a positive response, right? I mean, it's very rare, you know, that they don't. But I suppose, I mean, the one thing you would point to is perhaps maybe specific detail and pointed references maybe to work on the training ground. Whereas previously, you know, it might have been more when there was murmurs maybe that the training ground stuff wasn't great. Maybe there might have been more generalities about the manager. Whereas there's a bit more specifics, like everyone keeps referencing Keith Andrews and Anthony Barry. And like, you know, it's, you know, Anthony Barry always gets brought up, and I can't think of too many previous instances where like the third in command just gets brought up uninvited. It's not questions asking about Anthony Barry. He just seems to come up. So that is something which suggests like, and you were hearing that soundings post June that the summer camp, the training camp had gone well, that there was no complaints. Whatever about the discussion around Kenny's future in the last couple of months, you're not seeing like mischievous stuff coming out suggesting there's unhappiness around, you know, the setup. And the one thing I would say from being around the camp a bit more, because we're actually getting to travel and to sort of talk to people a bit more, like, I've covered the end of eras, you know, the end of regimes and stuff, and you always get a sense that something has reached its natural course. You know, we were talking to Nathan Collins earlier on, one of the younger players in the camp. You're talking to younger players, there's a certain freshness. It doesn't feel like this is something that's, you know, that people have been soured, that it's getting to the end of the road. It doesn't have that feeling. It really doesn't. Now, that doesn't make the debate any less relevant. I understand where the debate comes from. It's completely pertinent with his results. It's an entirely valid and deserved debate when your record has been that poor in terms of pure results. But certainly, in terms of the vibe around the place, you don't get the sense that there's some kind of mutinous, you know, counting down the clock till this guy goes feel. That's not the case at all. But obviously, the players have to do something on the pitch to make their words in the press conference seem grounded in reality.
Dan, great stuff. I'm sure we're going to chat to you a lot over the next few days.
Thank you, Nathan.
Oh, that's room service, is it? Room service caviar for Mr. McDonald?
I think there's something about the Turkish baths there. So the Turkish baths, apparently. So I might
nice bottle of red wine. Oh, right.
Dan. That's more an insight to your to what you do when you go to Brighton. You know, and all these places, you know, Mr. Big Dinners Murphy, they call him, I believe, in Off the Ball Towers.
Listen, that and much more, I suspect. All right, Dan, enjoy.
Thank you.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Sky. Don't miss Arsenal versus Everton in the Women's Super League. Sunday, live on Sky Sports.
It is Thursday's football show. Nathan with you this evening. Loads more build up to come to the Republic of Ireland against Azerbaijan over the next couple of days. Kenny Cunningham's on OTBAM tomorrow morning, and obviously we'll have reaction from Sunday. Kenny will be back, Brian Kerr as well. But let's turn our attention to the Premier League. It has been a heck of a start to the season for Brentford. Seven games in, they're sitting seventh in the table in their first season in the Premier League. Three wins, three draws, and just the one defeat from those opening seven matches, and some of the most memorable moments of the season as well in that draw against Liverpool and on that opening night of the season win against Arsenal. A key man behind the scenes at Brentford is Alan Walsh. He is an Irish man, a Mayo man, and he is the director of operations at Brentford. And I'm delighted that Alan is with us this evening. How are you keeping, Alan?
Not too bad, guys. Not too bad. Glad to join you for a nice little session talk about football.
Yeah, life must be pretty good at Brentford right now.
It is. I think we've hit the ground running, really, and we're making a bit of a noise and impact. So I think the whole world knows where Brentford is and what we're all about.
Tell us, for those who don't know, where Brentford is, because they'll see lots of London derbies, but it's not one of the more famous London clubs.
Agreed. I mean, I've been over in the UK since 93, and it's surprising. You say Brentford, people say Brentwood, you know, they haven't got a clue kind of where it is. But we're literally halfway between Heathrow Airport and the city of centre of London. So it's probably about 9-10 miles from the city centre, and ultimately about, what, 7-9 miles, you know what I mean, to Heathrow Airport, in between that, depending what terminal you're at. But prime West London club location, and we're putting the club and everything about the club on the map.
So it's Brentford's first time in the Premier League. It's been coming because obviously they've been very close in the Championship. It's a club with a very different business model to most others. It's all about the analytics. The owner also owns Midtjylland in Denmark, sort of tried it out there, how to bring new players through. There's been a lot made of the lack of an academy. That Brentford do things and almost take a Moneyball style approach to football. Talk about when you arrived at Brentford and what your expectations of the club were.
Well, I arrived at the club back in 2013. I was actually fortunate enough. I was working on the London 2012 Olympic Games. And I joined first time into football, done events and so forth before, but never in football before. Joined a club that was in League One and ultimately playing good, attractive football. Uwe Rosler was the manager at the time. And just kind of playing our style of football that was competing, and we were kind of creating a team that we wanted to kind of punch above our weight. But it took a bit of time, but ultimately a club that had probably on average attendance maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people turning up for a League One game in a very old ground. But the aspiration was to build a new stadium and also, you know, get into the Premier League. It was League One then, and ultimately, you know, we had a vision, and in fairness, the football department and co-directors of football brought us there.
Yeah, you talk about the football department. Then you're working in as the director of operations. What's your gig?
So my gig really is ensuring that the playing surfaces for football department, both at the training ground and at the main stadium, is fit for purpose. And also under my remit is ensuring that we got a stadium operating and safe. So from stewarding, catering, all the ticket access, all of that side of things comes under my remit to ensure we get people in safely and out safely. They can enjoy the match day experience and ultimately hopefully see good football. And major part of that as well is kind of facilitating the one of the major stakeholders, which is the broadcasters. So if it's your host broadcasters from Sky, BT, even Amazon now, to other broadcasters, international and so forth. So I deal with that pretty much at the day-to-day at the stadium and the training grounds. You know, we got 5 pitches down there, and the team spend 90-95% of their time doing all their work down there with the infrastructure we have down there.
Mm. The last 7 or 8 years then must have been some transformation as the team moves up from League One to Championship to Premier League in terms of budget, but also in terms of expectations. Like, you talk about even the media side of it. Like, when you think back to that first night against Arsenal, what a dream start in the Premier League, winning your first game. Everyone remembers the scenes, though, of Sky Sports, pitch side, Thomas Frank coming over, the supporters, the connection that was there. Is the club in any ways, does it look in any way like what it did when you first got in there 7, 8 years ago?
I think the first year I was at the club, it was very much it's a people's club. So we're very open and welcoming to new fans, new supporters, and even existing supporters, because they've gone through a lot of pain over numerous years from playoffs, even from like struggling of the club, when, you know, financial hardship before our owner Matthew Benham kind of assisted. So I think probably in 2014 onwards, you could kind of see a shift and a different approach within the football side and how we restructured. And we got two co-directors of football in there. And then there's a different philosophy. There was a different approach on how we do, you know, players coming into the club, developing them players. But we've always kind of stayed true to our kind of roots, and we develop players in a particular style. So when you spoke about Thomas Frank, Thomas is a great guy, full of energy. But actually, we've always had kind of managers, I would say, from the time we got Dean Smith on board. From once we had Dean, Thomas was part of his team. Dean is doing very well with Aston Villa. And ultimately, Thomas has kind of slotted in and just grown into the role. And, you know, the fans and supporters have followed that journey. And ultimately, he's had the days out where we managed to get to Wembley. He's had 2 cracks at it, because the first time, unfortunately, we didn't get there when we played Fulham. But we got through when we played, in Swansea in the final. And from there, I think his feet haven't probably touched the floor. You know, it's been a kind of whirlwind of the Premier League and so forth. But he loves it. And full credit to him. It's very infectious as well, because he actually gets off, you know, on the supporters, and he approaches it completely different. Where you'd have your normal, you'd have a different manager or a different head coach that might kind of say, "Oh, I'm Premier League and I want to do this." Thomas doesn't take anything for granted, and you know, he puts in the hard work. So do the players, and ultimately, I think the world has seen what we're all about.
we're really looking forward to getting back covering Premier League games in person again over the next few months and making that first trip to a stadium like Brentford. It's one of the smaller Premier League stadiums, and the move from the heritage of Griffin Park to the new community stadium, 17,000, it's probably a perfect capacity. I'd imagine behind the scenes was a hard balance to get right, that it's a very ambitious club, Brentford, but you don't want a 40,000-seater stadium that, you know, you're struggling to fill. That actually having that nice, tight community element really adds to what the club is all about.
Agreed. I mean, you know, the stadium, yes, it is. 17,250 is our capacity. When we designed it, because I was a part of the project team designing that, building it, and ultimately opening it up, you are right. I mean, look, Premier League brings a lot more success and a lot more people want to come in and see the football. We are currently the smallest stadium in the Premier League. I think when Bournemouth were in there, they were probably about 10 or 10,500. Mm. We are the smallest one. But it's not so much about capacities. I mean, look, I'd say we're the most, one of the most modern stadiums in the country. You know, everything is ready for Premier League football, from camera positions, from lighting, from sound. Everything we've done, we've made it easy for the broadcasters, so, you know, they can just come in, literally just plug and play. And likewise, we're the only dual sports stadium in London. We also do rugby, so London Irish play out of the stadium as well. They've just started their kind of campaign and they have a game on this Saturday coming up now. So it's fully accessible. It's the right size, I think, for the club, because when we planned it, we were in the Championship. We had aspirations absolutely to get to the Premier League, and now since we're in there, we want to stay in the Premier League. So I think it's the right size to grow the fan base. And to give you an idea, probably the penultimate year before we left Griffin Park, we had probably season ticket holders of 4,500. The last year at Griffin Park before COVID kicked in, we had just over 6,000 season ticket holders, and now at the new stadium, we migrated people across. Before we knew anything of COVID, we had 10,000 season ticket holders. So you're kind of growing that, and there's new people coming to the club. But I think you got to walk before you can run. And some people have asked, like, oh, could you expand it and could you make it bigger? Yes, ultimately you could, but it means buying more real estate, building over railway lines. And I think, to be honest, what we've designed, and it might have been evident when we played Arsenal, the sound and the acoustics within the stadium bowl is pretty loud. You're pretty close. I think you know, at any point you're like 6 meters away from the touchline. And if you go to other some stadiums, you're so far away from the actual, you know, the actual goal line or touchline. It's quite a unique experience. And I think when we had Sky Sports were down here, when we had Gary Neville and Jamie Redknapp, I think they were blown away really with what they could kind of experience and what you see. And when you're in the stadium, you know, it looks bigger than 17,250, and when people right. are all full out singing, it sounds like 40,000. And you know, I'm a football fan. I'm a Man U supporter, and I've been to Old Trafford at 76,000. You know, you're 74,000. You're up there, and in all honesty, sometimes if the football isn't great, it can be quiet, and yet it can be electric. So I have not heard a stadium for the number of people that can create the sound it does here, which is unreal.
Yeah, and I think it's what every football fan wants, is to be tied together, close to the ground. It was probably a bit of a shock for the Brentford fans last weekend across London at the Olympic Stadium, and how far back you can be from the pitch and how different an experience it is. You mentioned sharing the ground there, the community stadium, with London Irish. I'd imagine that is a bit of a stress for you. Thomas Frank wants a perfect playing surface for Brentford's slick style of football, and London Irish don't care too much about that.
Yeah, that's the biggest challenge that we will have coming in now to the winter months, and the sunlight, of course, is minimal. But that's part and parcel of what the team have to deliver and what we have to do. I mean, one advantage is, you know, last season, for example, we had a very much compressed season in the Championship. You know, Championship, you're having 8 more games than you have in the Premier League. That's 4 more games at home. We had a cup run as well. We had 5 home games. You know, we got to the semi-final of the Carabao Cup, and we had 5 games at home playing with FA Cup and Carabao Cup as well. So everything was condensed completely down into a program that started in September and finished in May. Lucky enough, we started in August this year. We've, you know, Premier League, it's less games. And of course, you know, we're continuing on. It's more spaced out. So it is the biggest challenge that we will have, is to maintain the perfect surface for the football department, for ensuring that they can play their game that they want. You know, biggest thing I always hate or dread is a ball is played back to the goalkeeper and it bobbles and they miss it and it goes in the goal. I mean, you know, we've seen it happen in a few years back, but the expectation on surface, playing surface is high. And that's the biggest challenge. So, you know, we have the technology, we've got grow lights, we've undersoil heating, and we've got a hybrid deso stitch pitch. So we've got everything that can make it happen. All we need is probably a little bit of luck from the weather. So you don't have a big rugby game on when it's heavily raining and scrummage and so forth. But it's what we do.
Yeah. In your role, like the job is making sure that nothing goes wrong, that everything just runs smoothly. You must have just taken enormous satisfaction then from that night against Arsenal, where the crowd are in the stadium. You've had to move to a new stadium throughout COVID. You're going into the Premier League with the eyes of the world on you, the increased media commitments, the increased attention, everything that bit bigger. And it doesn't just go smoothly. It seems from the outside, at least, to run to absolute perfection.
To be honest, I have to give credit to my team and my fellow colleagues as well at the organisation at Brentford. Look, we opened a stadium. We got the keys for the stadium under COVID conditions in the 7th of August, and basically had to had our first game pre-season game. Well, we got the keys, I should say, 7th of August. We had to get a safety certificate, which we got probably about 2 weeks just after that. And then ultimately, we had a friendly game on the 1st of September against Oxford, and we had a Carabao Cup game we broadcasted in on the 6th of September. So no one has probably got the keys, opened a stadium, got a safety certificate and operators within that period of time. And then we ultimately had to, you know, opening the opening game for the Premier League with crowds back in full force. So, you know, the stadium had two preseason games. So we had like 7,500 and 10,000. It was never actually had at capacity until we had the Arsenal game. And you're kind of ensuring ticketing goes well, you know, no failures in power, making sure the broadcasts are all looked after, and a huge kind of external, you know, overseas, all the different kind of broadcasts that was coming through, and even the Premier League were down. You know, we had the chief executive of the Premier League down as well on that, just to kind of experience it, and the head coach of the England team, Mr. Southgate, was even down. So just gives you an idea. You had the eyes of the world looking on us, and look, behind the scenes, there's a couple of little things that might have happened, but no showstoppers. You know, so that's what we do.
What's the worst thing that's happened?
Well, to give you an idea, people don't realize we had a fire alarm go off at 30 minutes before kickoff. You know, and all our lifts kind of go down. So that fire alarm, we were in silent mode, so we investigate that. It was probably a bit overeager, maybe chef, but what we didn't want to do is have to evacuate a stadium if there was, you know, if there was nothing happening. So that gives you an idea of what was on behind the scenes. But, you know, ultimately we deal with it, we manage it, and we get everything reset, get back on and go from there. That's just some of the kind of day-to-day things we have to do on a match day. And it's been able to react dynamically as well. I mean, on the day, we found out as well, you know, the game was at, if I'm right, I think it was 8 o'clock kickoff, and we had Arsenal. We found out that we're bringing an additional coach. Now, JB, you're probably not familiar, but the site, we've a stadium that's operating, but all around as well, we've got residential apartments being built, and a lot of them are coming along. It's still kind of like a building site at the very front of our front doors. And they told us literally 4 hours before kickoff that they're bringing an additional coach. So, of course, these are like kind of Dreamliner coaches coming in. We've got, normally you'd allow for pre-COVID, you'd have, you know, your team is coming in as one Dreamliner coach coming in. Over COVID conditions, it's usually two, but Arsenal brought three. And you've got to park them up, and you've got to make sure that you still get people in and around and have emergency evacuation routes clear, all of that kind of stuff. So that just gives you an idea how we have to manage crowds, people, and ultimately get people in and let them experience a very historic, memorable, nice. And yeah. I think, to be honest, we look, without blowing our own trumpets here, I think we set the scene for the Premier League. That whole weekend, everyone was on about, isn't it great to have crowds back? And I think we made a loud impact on the pitch, off the pitch. And, you know, I think everyone in the world realised what Brentford was all about. And ultimately, we were competing. We won a game, first game, and kind of set the tone, really.
Yeah, at the end of the first night of the season, knowing you're going to be on the end of season highlights reel is a pretty good feeling, I'd imagine. What are the ambitions for Brentford? What? Because obviously, every newly promoted side, particularly a team like Brentford, who are in the Premier League for the first time, we talk about survival, and there's been that initial burst that we've seen from Leeds last season, Sheffield United. We don't even want to get into second season syndrome when first we're not even a quarter of the way through the first season. But is the aim of the club, the spoken aim of the club, to become a force within the Premier League? Is it Champions League football? Is that talked about publicly?
I think I'd probably get shot by commenting on stuff on this. But I think in all honesty, we're not here to make up numbers. We're not here to kind of just survive. We're here to compete. And, we want to get into Europe. That's ultimately, we want to play European football at the stadium. Whether that's Europa League or whether that's Champions League, that's ultimately the aspiration, I would say, in the next, this season, if not maybe for next season. You need a little bit of luck. You are right. You've seen Leeds kind of come up and for teams come up for the first time out of the Championship. I've kind of, in my own view, I've kind of analysed it and looked at it. And I think the Championship is a completely different league compared to the Premier League. And I think we were, out of all the teams that got promoted to the Premier League, even for the last probably two or three seasons, I think we're probably the best suited team to compete in the Premier League. Premier League football is exactly what we're kind of playing in the Championship, except Championship is probably a bit more physical, and you don't have VAR, and you're probably referees that have a bit of a 50-50 ball, or we'll let it run. Where in the Premier League, we've seen all the reviews and bits and pieces. I won't say players are more protected in the Premier League, but it's a lot more physical in the Championship. And I think that's why I fully believe you're going to hear Brentford in the Premier League in the next 3, 4, 5, if not longer, years to come.
Great. All our football and off the ball is brought to you by Sky. All the football you love in one place across Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports. Alan, just before I let you go, it's always good to see a Mayo man doing well abroad. But Mikhail Park has been, hasn't been kind to the Mayo footballers. They're digging the whole thing up. Would you not come back and sort out Mayo football?
Jeez, you never know, actually.
Show me the money!
Well, in fairness, I hear that they've put a new pitch down. I haven't actually seen it in there. And I'm hoping to get back over for half term, probably the back end of October, for a week. So I might try and take a trip in and just see what they're doing in there. Gaelic football pitches, they're longer, the cut height slightly higher as well. It's a different type of game compared to soccer, as we know. And you need to keep your footing in there, and you need to kind of have a response of ball hops and so forth. The weather in Ireland as well, as we know, can be the biggest challenge. It rains a lot, and it's having the right infrastructure there. But we wait and see. The last visit I was in McHale Park was actually seeing Mayo lose against Galway a few years back in a Connacht, I think it was a Connacht final or semi final. It was a Connacht final, I think it was. So I'm hoping to get back there and see a game in the next maybe the next round of the Championship, or the league games if need be next season.
Yeah. Well, Alan, listen, pleasure to talk to you. Very best of luck and continued success with Brentford.
No worries. Thanks a lot for giving us a call, and keep a lookout, and hopefully you'll be tuning in to see us play Chelsea at 5:30 on the 16th of October.
Absolutely. Great stuff, Alan.